Welcome back, everyone, to the Movie Palace. As ever, I'm your host, Carl Sweeney, and thank you for joining me for this episode, in which I'm going to be talking about the great legal drama from 1957, Sidney Lumet's 12 Angry Men. A wonderful, wonderful film. And I'm absolutely delighted to be joined on this podcast to talk about the film by none other than criminal lawyer Kathy Glinsky. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Carl.
It's really nice to talk to you. I mean, I should explain that, it's probably been almost a couple of years, really, that we've been kind of interacting a little bit on Twitter and so on, because, through the kind of community that sprang up around the XCast, the other podcast I'm on.
Yeah, I think that's about right.
Yeah, something like that. And but this is the first time we've spoken properly, so it's really nice to have this kind of opportunity to chat, really.
Yeah, this is a lot of fun.
And, I mean, just tell us, I mean, I used the term criminal lawyer there as kind of an introduction, but I don't know if that covers it exactly. So, I mean, what exactly can you tell us about what it is that you do, Kathy?
Yeah, criminal lawyer covers it. I'm a defense attorney, so I'm usually appointed by the court to represent clients, and I do appeals. So it's once they've been convicted, if they have a constitutional right to an appeal, then I'm brought on to the case to handle that.
Cool. So let me just explain what we're going to try to do anyway, because I think this should be a lot of fun. We're going to try and put 12 Angry Men under like the legal microscope, as it were. We're going to kind of talk about the film in terms of what it says about like the legal system and stuff like that. So we'll do a little bit of the usual stuff where we talk about how great it is as like entertainment and stuff. But we're going to try and take this tack with it. And I don't know about you, Kathy, but I think it's one that there's a lot to say about, you know.
Yeah, I was really kind of surprised when I rewatched it how much I had to say. I took like pages and pages of notes, so this will be good.
I mean, let's talk a bit, first of all, about like, you know, courtroom drama or legal dramas in general, because generally speaking, I find them, you know, I find it quite an entertaining genre to watch.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering what it's like for someone like you who obviously, you know, this is your career. So how does it for you to sit down and watch, you know, the average courtroom drama, whatever it might be?
Yeah, you know, it's fun. It's a lot of fun, but I sometimes find myself screaming at the screen like, that's just stupid. They wouldn't do that kind of thing. The thing is, like you said, they're very entertaining to watch, but if they were really accurate, they'd be way too boring. Trials are not that dramatic and exciting. So, you know, it's okay to show some of the inaccurate moments just to get you through, so you're not listening to 3 days of testimony to get one point. Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose the comparison that I sort of think of is like for me, my background's in teaching, you know, and I think when you see like classrooms and teaching in films, it tends to be either like incredibly like inspirational teachers or teachers who have like no control whatsoever. And in reality, most teachers are somewhere, you know, in between that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I guess it's the same. And yeah. Both my parents work in the prison service here in England. And, you know, I don't think that if you think about prisons in films, you see a lot of escapes, don't you? And,
yeah.
I don't think there's much dramatic value in like, watching a prisoner quietly serve a sentence and then rejoin society, you know. So I guess it's kind of like that, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, what about courtroom dramas and on film or on TV? Do you have any particular favorites that spring to mind that have been particularly, whether it's entertaining or accurate or whatever it might be?
Yeah, I do. I have, in addition to 12 Angry Men, Anatomy of a Murder is my favorite all time. It might be my favorite movie, but it's definitely my favorite legal movie. I love that the defense attorney is the hero. Personally, that's kind of nice for me. The prosecutors, there's two of them. One's bumbling and one's evil. So, you know, that's good. But I love it, you know, it's fairly accurate in the how it portrays the trial. And the defense attorney does everything right. The defendant has a fair trial. The defense wins. But you're left questioning the result. And, you know, that's a position you find yourself in as a defense attorney. So I love that. Another is To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh, of course, yeah.
I like to say that's why I became a lawyer, but most lawyers say that. So, but in that case, the defense attorney did everything right, but he loses, and yet you know the client's innocent. So I, you know, I love the contrast between those two. And then My Cousin Vinny. You know, it's surprisingly accurate. They have this real little picky evidence rule, and they use it the right way. But it's just fun. So.
I'll tell you the one moment from that film that I always laugh when I sort of remember is I think there's a scene where the other lawyer finishes interviewing a witness, and then Joe Pesci just stands up and says, like, everything that last guy just said is bullshit.
Yeah.
And, I'm sure that's probably not a tactic you've adopted much.
Probably
in,
not. You try to find better ways to say it. That's just specious, you know?
Yeah. I love all of those examples. Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you one... I'll tell you a TV series I really liked. I don't know if you will have seen it. It was in the mid-90s. It was called Murder One, where the whole, like, season was covering one case, you know, and it went through all, you know, there was an episode where the main thrust of it was, like, selecting the jury, and, you know, it seemed quite thorough in comparison to a lot of TV trials that you see. Did you ever see that one?
I don't remember if I did or not. If I did, I haven't thought of it in years.
Yeah, that was a good one. And there was a film with Paul Newman called The Verdict,
yes,
that I liked.
Yeah. From,
I think it must have been like the early 80s. He was kind of struggling with a drink problem, I think. And yeah, that was a good one. That's also by Sidney Lumet, who directed this film.
Oh, but, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, but Paul Newman is a great actor, and he was really good in that role, I thought.
Yeah, he was.
Okay, so any least favourites? Any that really make you want to, like, throw something at the TV screen?
You know, Double Jeopardy. And, you know, there wasn't too much in the court, but it was just so stupid and so wrong, and yeah.
Yeah, so this is the thriller with Ashley Judd. So remind me, I sort of remember it was about you can't be convicted for the same crime twice or something. Is that
right, yeah. And so since you've already been convicted and now we've reversed it, go ahead and kill him because it's free. You know, it's like... It just doesn't work that way.
You're telling me that's not true?
No.
All these years.
Don't give that a try.
Yeah, no, I wasn't... I can't really think of one off the top of my head that I really dislike. Because, like I said, even if you got a really substandard one, I normally find, like, the procedural aspect of a courtroom drama carries you a certain way.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But, I mean, this film we're talking about today, courtroom drama isn't really accurate because so little of it is in the courtroom, isn't it? There's
right.
a one scene very early on, but it's all about the jury deliberations, really. So, I mean, we're going to talk about 12 Angry Men. It was a film, you know, it originated as a TV play, I think. Then it became a stage play. And then it was after that that Lumet made the film adaptation that we know and love and we, you know, continue to watch today. So, I'll tell you what, before we get into 12 Angry Men, this is what we should do, probably, is... Let's think about the jury system in general. So it's one of those things that I've always just kind of taken for granted. You know, there are courtrooms, there are trials, and, you know, certain criminal cases, you have juries. I'm not exactly sure, you know, how the system differs from country to country. But it's one of those things that I've never given it a great deal of thought because, like, I've never been to court myself. You know, I've never been arrested or anything as of the time of recording, you know, so it's something I'm kind of in the dark about. So first things first, I really want to be on a jury. That's the first thing I wanted to say. It's it looks like a lot of fun. I'm sure it isn't, but I think there must be, I don't know, I don't even care what the crime would be or the case would be, but something that takes a lot of thought and, you know, a bit of time to resolve, I imagine could be quite interesting to think about. What do you reckon?
You know, I think it could be very interesting. It also could be really tedious. There's so much time that the jury spends in the jury room while the attorneys and the judge are working out evidentiary rulings and procedure. And I think that's one of the things attorneys have to really fight against, is not alienating the jury by making them wait forever, you know? But I think I've only been on one jury myself, and it wasn't a criminal case. I don't think I would get a criminal case if I were ever seated, but it was fun. It was amazing being part of the process, you know, that, you know, it exists for a reason, and to be part of it is really awesome. I think anyone who gets the chance should do it, or, you know, not just look for an excuse to get out of it. So,
yeah, I mean, you say like it exists for a reason. So perhaps we could just talk a little about that. So, I mean, what are the advantages of the jury system? Because like I say, it's something that I've always just kind of, you know, I take it for granted and I've never had to really experience it myself. So what are the real strengths of it as like a system, would you say?
The reason you have a jury, especially for a criminal case, which is what we're talking about, is to protect the defendant against a corrupt prosecutor, you know, being charged with unfounded crimes, and also against a judge who's really just going to rubber stamp anything that's put in front of him. So you want the jury of the peers to balance that out, to really protect the rights of this individual who's being charged and faces the loss of liberty.
Now, it's interesting, I think, because I think you see some of the real strengths of the jury system in this film.
Yeah.
But arguably, you see some of the drawbacks, too. But, like, how would you kind of put it? Like, what are the disadvantages you can get from having a jury?
Well, one of the things is, you know, juries are presumed to follow the law, which the court gives them instructions and they're presumed to follow it. But there's really no way to know that that's happening, because whatever the jury does in deliberations is secret. No one's going to record it, or, you know, there's no court reporter taking it down. No one's going to ask them what they did and said in there. So you have to just really assume that they understood the law and that they're going to do what they're supposed to do. There's a problem with bias, you know, but just as you're afraid of a biased prosecutor or judge, you know, jurors could be biased, and you try to weed that out as you're doing your jury selection, but it doesn't always work. And we see that a lot in the movie. Oh, and, you know, jury nullification can be an issue, and that's when you've got a case and it's an open and shut case and the jury just doesn't feel like they should convict this guy, you know, so it's another issue that could happen. I think it's a little more rare, but.
So would that be like when sometimes you hear people say, like, no jury in the land would ever convict so-and-so? Is that the kind of thing you mean?
Or the unwritten law. They talk about that in Anatomy of a Murder, but the jury's feelings are going to be on my side. They're going to know he deserved to be killed anyway, so I'm going to get away with it, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So, like, how did this system come to be? I mean, how long has the United States had juries, that kind of thing? Has it been, like, you know, a cornerstone of the system for a long, long time?
Yeah, it's the Sixth Amendment to our Constitution. So, you know, it was added pretty fairly quickly after the country was founded. So it's in there saying that an accused has a right to a jury trial, a public trial. He can be confronted with the witnesses against him and have compulsory process. So he's allowed to bring the witnesses in to testify, and then has to have assistance of counsel. And so all of that is right there in the Sixth Amendment. And it was, it was brought in from the common law, from what was already in place. So it's not like this was revolutionary.
Yeah. And what about, like, the way it's changed over the years? Because I think in terms of the film, one of the striking things is, you know, it is 12 men, isn't it? There are no women. So is that because, you know, there were no female jurors at that time? Or was it an issue with a particular state, or, you know?
That's something that's changed a lot. I can't even speak to whether it was outlawed to have women on the jury, or if it was just customary and they were always, if a woman was called in, they were always excused. At some point, I'm not sure when this shift was made, but women were allowed to be seated. And I would be surprised if it wasn't before 1957. But I'm not surprised that in 1957 there would still be 12 angry men on a jury.
Yeah.
So that is a big change that's happened since then. And racial diversity too. You can tell that they're trying to present a diverse jury in this movie, that, you know, they've got people from different backgrounds, but it's still, you know, white men.
So would that be like, you know, if you had a similar case, you know, in reality today, would the jury kind of by default, would it end up kind of more racially balanced, or would you expect it to be?
You would expect it to be, absolutely. Yeah. There's that is a major area of concern in the criminal justice system, is making sure that the jury is representative of the community that's where the trial is being held. And a defense attorney can object if he thinks the prosecutor is using racial motivation to dismiss jurors or to challenge jurors. So it's something that the courts have to be aware of. It's not perfect. I don't think we're anywhere near perfect yet, but definitely we've moved in the right direction.
And it's so pertinent in regards to this film, isn't it? Because you see all sorts of prejudices come out from various jurors, really. It's not just, there's juror number 10 in particular, but a few of them, actually. Let's talk about the film as a slice of entertainment, first of all, because I just think it's marvelously entertaining. I could watch it again and again, and I have done, to be honest. I watched it like 4 times this year already.
Yeah.
And how good do you think it is?
I think it's fantastic.
It is.
It's just gripping.
It just, like, brilliantly, it's got this great premise, isn't it? And it kind of keeps it up in a way that you never, as a viewer, you're never confused. you know, the jurors want to get out of there, but the audience is quite happy, you know, never gets bored, I don't think.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
And I think it's because, you know, Sidney Lumet handles it really well, because the fact that you've got actors constantly moving around in some way, you know, they're walking to the window, they're trying to get the fan to work, or they're having a bathroom break, stuff like that, confronting each other. It just means it's not too kind of static, I think, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, you can imagine in the hands of a lesser director, it would have just been the guys basically sat at the table kind of talking it out, really.
Right, know? Right, yeah. Yeah, this does not ever... And there's some shots that are just so brilliant, you know, there's been a confrontation and then suddenly you realize it's 1 against 11, and you know, just the way they've moved in the room, it very, very entertaining. It never slows down.
Like great close-ups on the faces as well, isn't there, I think. And I'll tell you what I like, and I was going to ask you about this a bit later, is like the concept they have where there's this sequence of votes that kind of run through the film, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's a great hook. It really like builds attention into the story, you know, because you sort of count them off, don't you? It gradually goes from 1v11 to 11v1.
I'm counting it on my fingers as they go, you know, how many on each side. Yeah, that was a really good hook to keep you interested.
But also I think it's that the cast are so fantastic, aren't they? And I wouldn't have any exceptions personally, because you've got people like, in my notes I've got him referred to as Quincy, but you know, Jack Klugman. just because it's quicker to write, you know, but he's great, you know. Martin Balsam is the foreman of the jury.
Okay, yeah.
He's really good, I think. I like E.G. Marshall, who's the guy with the glasses, who never sweats.
Oh, right.
I think he's a really good, like, foil. But of course, Henry Fonda is the main man, and he's just fantastic in the lead role, I think.
He is. Yeah. You want to be swayed by him, although you can get angry with him once in a while, too. He just plays it perfectly.
Yeah, none of them are perfect, are they? Because it's like, what's so good about it, I think, is he doesn't come in with the whole case figured out.
Mm-mm.
You know, he kind of wants to talk about it.
Yeah.
And then some of the others kind of help him out as they go along. And I felt that was a really, like, canny way to kind of develop it. You know, it wasn't too kind of idealistic or something.
Right.
Let's delve into this one from, like, a legal perspective then, if we can. So, in a nutshell, overall, I should say, how credible do you think this is, this film? Are there any obvious, like, dramatic liberties that you think they've taken?
I think there are some obvious dramatic liberties, but I have to tell you that the jury deliberation is the one thing lawyers and judges never see. So whether it's accurate or not, I don't know. But I think they did a really great job showing what the problems are with the legal system just by the way the jurors talk it out. So, you know, there's some things like at the beginning where before they've started their deliberations, the juror members start talking about the case. And that's probably a dramatic liberty. You know, they're not allowed to do that. They can't talk about the case unless they're all talking together. But this is a way to introduce the characters, just give you a feel for who they are. And I think it was very effective dramatically, but it wouldn't necessarily have occurred, or it shouldn't occur.
All right, so let's run through some of the specifics. And I'll tell you one thing about this film that always kind of bothers me. In a funny sort of way, is the judge at the beginning of the film, you know, because, you know, we see that quick scene in the courtroom before they go off to the to do their deliberations. And the judge really seems to me like he's just going through the motions. It seems like he's not too invested.
Yeah.
I mean, does that bother you? Should that happen?
That's exactly, I wrote that down. He looks so bored and there's an 18-year-old kid about to lose his life.
Yeah.
You know, so that bothered me. It bothered me a lot. And one of the things the judge said that really, like, really struck me is that this is a death penalty. It's mandatory. I can't entertain any plea for mercy. I had to look that up. The mandatory death penalty was abolished in 1976, so it still would have been in place there. But the fact that the judge could be so bored when he's talking about a mandatory death penalty was just outrageous.
You would hope, if you were on trial for whatever it might be, you'd hope the judge would be a bit more kind of invested than he was.
Exactly.
And so then all the jurors go off to the jury room, and like I said about my background in teaching, like, I know how important, like, the environment of a classroom could be. So I was sort of thinking about this room, you know, because I think the environment must be quite important for such a significant discussion as this. But the room's, like, really cramped, it seems like.
Yeah.
Obviously, they have this thing where it's the hottest day of the year or whatever.
Right.
And they can't get the fan working. And plus, they're all smoking, like, all the while as well.
Right.
Which probably doesn't add, you know, help too much. But, you know, is this room suitable? Is that the kind of room you would like a jury to be kind of sent to deliberate?
No. I mean, you don't want them kicking their feet up in a recliner because they've got a job to do. But, you know, how common was air conditioning back then? I don't know. It just, you're right, it seemed like very cramped and the chairs didn't look very comfortable. And I'd be wanting to get out of there as quickly as I could, you know. I would be more concerned about my own comfort than about getting the job done accurately.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it's conducive to the purpose they need it for. Although, in fairness, they do get the fan working later on, don't they?
Yeah, when they turn the lights on.
Exactly. So maybe if they'd have sorted that out a little earlier, they might have been... It might have been okay.
The bailiff didn't do his job. He should have walked him through how to turn the fan on.
There we go. I mean, they come up with a system, don't they? It seemed quite sensible to me, but I'm curious to get your take on it. So they say it's customary to take like a preliminary vote, you know. But like the whole voting system in general, because what I like in terms of it as drama is it's quite fluid, you know, because sometimes they have a secret ballot. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they have a show of hands.
Yeah.
Sometimes they kind of call out the vote. You know, I just felt they kind of helped liven up the drama a bit.
Yeah.
But as a kind of system for a jury to use, do you think it was quite a workable one or what?
Yeah, I think so, because I think it kept them at different stages of the drama. They had different reasons for how they were doing the voting. And I think that's very realistic. I think having them just do a quick preliminary vote made a lot of sense, just because, I mean, most of them were hoping, okay, let's vote and get out of here.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that was a very effective way to present it dramatically, but I think it is also a very effective way for the jury to work through what they're doing.
So, but there are no like rules on that, are there? Like
no.
Today, you wouldn't be mandated to do it that way. No,
no, no. Even I was surprised they came in already knowing who the foreman was.
Mm.
And juries are usually told that your first job is to select a foreman or a foreperson. So I thought that was interesting that they had already had him selected. I don't know when that happened and who did it. So
I suppose that's something you can see being something that, you know, the drama that really would have slowed down things, maybe.
Absolutely.
I suppose.
Yeah, that would have been a boring conversation.
Yeah. One of the things that I think it's juror number 12. He's the guy he talks about. He's like an ad agency guy.
Such
yeah.
An ass.
Yeah, he's the one later. He kind of changes his mind and then changes it back again.
Yeah, exactly.
And then eventually ends up on the right side, I suppose. But he says, like, we were lucky to get a murder case, you know.
Yeah.
And like, I know what he means, I think. Uh-huh. I can see where he's coming from. But do you think he's right to say that? Do you think it is lucky to get a murder case?
I think that he's being pretty flip, you know.
Yeah.
It's like this. He's forgetting that what's at stake here. It's all just a little entertainment for him. I think that's a real problem with his character throughout the whole movie, you know.
Yeah, because he's like doodling and stuff while they're trying to talk and that kind of thing, isn't he? That's right. Right, so the foreman, played by Martin Balsam, and he's a great character actor. He pops up in a lot of stuff, you know, that's really good. He seems to like, as a foreman, he seems to kind of grow into the role. He seems to have a few like early jitters, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But then he seems to get a bit better, I thought. I mean, what did you think? And like, how important is the foreman role overall? You know, if you have a bad foreman, how much is it going to kind of muck things up, do you think?
Oh, that's interesting. I think that if he wasn't sensitive to making sure that everyone gets a chance to speak, and at one point when Jack Klugman doesn't want to, he wants to pass on his vote, and he says, oh, well, that's okay. You know, should the foreman have forced the issue at that point? Probably. But, I think if you have a bad one who's just trying to rush you through or who's dominating the conversation and not letting everyone get a chance to speak, then it could really affect how the jury's going to vote.
The main issue he seemed to have is somebody challenges him at one point and he's like, you take the chair, you chair the discussion. But he seemed to kind of calm down a little thereafter, I think.
Yeah.
One of the big kind of problems on this jury is juror number 10. He's the guy played by Ed Begley. He's the one who's quite openly racist, I think. The one who has that big outburst later on where they all kind of turn their backs on him and they walk away.
Exactly, yeah.
I think quite early, though, you know, earlier than that, he talks about, he sort of says, like, these people are born liars and stuff like that. So it seems to me like he probably shouldn't have got through the selection process, but I suppose the question is, like, how would the lawyers have known, assuming he kept all those opinions to himself earlier?
Right, and I was thinking about that. There's a lot of biases that come out. There's like, I'd slap those tough kids down before they start trouble. He got a fair trial. He's lucky he got that. You know, we spent so much money on it. And I've lived among them all my life. You can't trust a word they say. So there's a lot of that that comes out. And I was thinking, you know, how do you root that out in jury selection, because if you know, if you're obvious, if the prosecutor and defense attorney are asking questions obviously intended to expose bias, are the jurors going to be honest in their answers? Do they, you know, are they going to try to hide these prejudices that they've got? It's a really tough one. I mean, there's some really, really strong opinions that were expressed there that I think probably should have been exposed, and not, they shouldn't have been seated. But yeah, it's tricky. How do you, because I think that that's an easy thing to hide as well. You give the answer that you think that the attorneys want to hear, and so your real thoughts aren't exposed, so you get it seated on the jury, even though you're biased. Yeah.
So how does it work these days in terms of things like, you know, all sorts of people have got like questionable social media histories and things? Would that kind of come to light during like jury selection these days?
You know, I think that they can, you can ask questions about that kind of thing. And I think attorneys do ask questions about that, but it really is the same problem. You know, who's going to, unless the questions are asked so carefully, you're not necessarily going to get an honest answer or one that's going to expose the bias you're looking for.
Hmm. I'll tell you, one of the things I'd forgotten is that juror number four, he's the guy with glasses, E.G. Marshall. I'd always remembered him being one of the more kind of thoughtful jurors, and I think he is in most respects, but he also talks about like slums are breeding grounds for criminals and that kind of thing, and I'd just forgotten that. I thought that was kind of, you know, you see the prejudices come in from all sides, really, don't you?
Yeah, that's really interesting, isn't it? Because he's the one you think is one of the more reasonable ones, and he's just looking at the evidence, but he's got that prejudice in his mind as he's looking at the evidence.
Yeah, and he, at the time, he doesn't know. So it's kind of unwitting, but he sat next to Jack Klugman's character, who's kind of was born in these environments and so on.
Yeah.
Right. So there's a great scene where they go around the table. They kind of outline why everybody voted the way they did. Or, you know, not everybody speaks, but most of them seem to.
Uh-huh.
And it allows us as viewers, we hear about the various pieces of evidence, don't we? Because we hear, you know, he couldn't remember the films he'd seen. Somebody saw him commit the crime, supposedly. He had a criminal record, etc. So we get a sense of what the prosecution case was, don't we? Even though we don't see how it was kind of argued.
Uh-huh.
And it sounds like, you know, they've got an eyewitness. There's a lot of evidence that's, it seemed kind of circumstantial to me, but some of it on the face of it was quite convincing. So like at this point in the film, I don't know, it sounds like it's a fairly open and shut case the way they talk about it, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it absolutely does. And that's where you were jury number eight was so good, because he wasn't going to just buy it. But yeah, even the very first juror to talk, when they're going around trying to convince juror number eight to change his mind, he says, well, I just thought he's guilty and no one proved otherwise, you know. And the prosecutor seemed like a pretty smart guy. He knew what he was talking about. He had it all together. And defense attorney didn't seem too interested in helping his client. So it's like, you know, you get an idea of what the state's case was, but you also get an idea that a lot of extraneous factors tend to influence the jury. That was one thing I found was really interesting. It's like, you know, he must be a smart guy, and oh, he must be stupid. And that's not really examining the evidence, is it? The jury I was on, we actually, I didn't do this, but there were people who were actually saying, did you see that one lawyer's shoes, how scuffed up they were? And they were brown with a gray suit, and the suit was so rumpled. How are we supposed to trust this guy? I mean, that goes on. And, you know, I think we saw a little bit of that in this movie, too.
Yeah. Well, even to the fact that, like, Henry Fonda refers to the defense lawyer being court appointed, you know, and like the implication he sort of says is like he may not have wanted the case, he may not have cared too much, etc.
Yeah.
So it's, I don't know, it sounds like a bit of an assumption there too, you know, and I wonder if that is, you know, a fair thing to say or not. Probably not.
It can be. I mean, public defenders, if their caseload is so huge that they don't have enough time to spend with all their clients, I mean, they've got a reputation as not caring, and that's one of the reasons, is they can't. And there actually has been a lot of litigation lately over that. Just like, you cannot assign this many cases to one attorney and say you're providing adequate counsel. And so, yeah, I think that just the way the deliberations played out, it you have to wonder, did defense counsel do anything? Because Henry Fonda's doing it all. I mean, everything, every argument he made should have come from the defense.
Yeah, and that's kind of the question, isn't it? Is like, you know, I sort of, when I think of 12 Angry Men and I haven't seen it for a while, I think, oh, it's this great uplifting film where justice seems to be done and so on. But really, it's showing you, you know, it, without Henry Fonda being there, being selected for the jury, you know, the guy gets convicted and justice isn't carried out. So you can't rely on, you know, having somebody like Juror Number 8 like all the time, can you?
No, no. That's the attorneys do play a role, and doesn't seem like the defense attorney did. Although one thing that was interesting is one of the jurors said, well, he didn't ask the questions because he must have known the answers would hurt. And that could be true as well. I mean, there are a lot of times where the defense attorney doesn't bring something up just because he knows that that's not going to help the case. That's going to hurt the case. And so in which case the prosecutor wasn't doing his job because he should have brought it up and made it clear.
Yeah, and also I suppose I was thinking about that in respect to the, you know, that scene where they recreate like the old man's walk.
Yeah.
And there's a suggestion, isn't there, that the lawyer may not have wanted to like badger an old man on the stand. So did that seem kind of plausible to you?
Absolutely. That's, you know, what I do in my job is I read the transcripts of the trial and the times when the jury's out in the, you know, waiting in their room while the attorneys are making arguments about you know, what can come in before the jury, what the judge is going to allow. One of the hugest things they talk about is, well, we don't want to present it this way because I don't want to make that objection in front of the jury. I don't want to ask these questions because it's going to alienate them. They're going to think I'm just picking on this poor old witness. And so that's something that has to be balanced out. You know, where do you draw that line? Do you challenge the witness to show that this evidence isn't strong, or is the jury going to think you're just picking on some helpless old guy? So that was a really brilliant line to have in there.
I'll tell you what my favorite moment is from this film. It gives me chills every time I see it, and even just thinking about it, actually, it's that moment where Henry Fonda brings the knife out of his pocket.
That is my favorite time. Yeah.
Yeah, it's brilliant. He slams it down on the table, of course.
It's just jury misconduct, plain and simple.
Well, I was going to say, it raises an interesting question, because they talk about, you know, you bought that knife, you broke the law. So he knowingly broke the law in purchasing the knife. But to be honest, in the circumstances, and I suppose it's because of the dramatic way he kind of flourishes it and stuff, but it seems very justified to me in this instance. But I don't know, is it justifiable to break the law?
No, that is pure dramatic license. Jurors are not allowed to do their own investigating. He shouldn't have even walked through the neighborhood. They're not allowed to investigate. They can't bring evidence into the jury room. But I love it. It's so good. But, you know, it's another thing that defense attorney should have taken care of. He should have sent an investigator out to that neighborhood to find out whether those knives are common and whether they're easily purchased and everything. But no, that's the best moment of the movie, and it's the moment that never should have happened.
Yeah. All right. So there's a great exchange. I think they have some kind of break from proceedings, you know, and Henry Fonda goes to the bathroom to kind of cool off and stuff. And juror number 6, who's played by Edward Binns, he's one of the, he seems like kind of a working class guy, not the guy with the hat, the other one, the one who sat next to him, I think.
Right.
And he says, you know, suppose you talk us out of this and the boy really did knife his father.
Yeah.
And this seems to be, I mean, you might know the genesis of this, but there's like kind of a maxim that I've heard a little bit over the years, where it's like, better to let 10 guilty people go free than to let one innocent party suffer.
Right.
But like, what do you make of that as an argument?
No, I think that's the whole crux of the jury system and the burden of proof. And that's one thing that this movie did a really good job of highlighting, is how difficult a concept that is. It's like, they kept talking about, I think the old man says, the boy's probably guilty, but I want to hear more. And then that other guy says, suppose you talk us out of it, and he really did knife his father. I mean, probably isn't enough. That's the whole point. You have to be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt. And so that does mean that it's possible you're going to let someone who is guilty go free. And they kept talking about, well, I'm not sure if he's innocent. And that's really not the question. You're not saying guilty or innocent. You're saying guilty, or you didn't prove he's guilty. So he could be guilty, but we're not convinced. And that's, I don't know, that's the risk you take. And I think that you've got to have that to protect, though. You don't want to send someone who's not guilty to prison. And especially when the penalty is mandatory death sentence, you know, you have to be sure.
Yeah, because they talk about it, don't they? Because what happens in the film is you get like this kind of like if Henry Fonda's the hero, then the guy played by Lee J. Cobb is kind of the antagonist, I suppose. He's like kind of the last holdout as well, isn't he? And like I think Fonda says to him at one point, like, "Are you his executioner?" And he comes back and says, "I'm one of them." Yeah. And you know, for all I kind of say quite jokingly, you know, I'd love to be on a jury, etc. And I would, but it is a big ask of an individual, isn't it? When, you know, we're talking about sending somebody to their death, you know, it's not too hard to imagine it taking like a big psychological toll on a juror, is it? Are there any kind of support systems for jurors, you know, who might kind of feel the strain of it? Or, you
know? Oh, well, that's a good question. I don't know.
But it is like a big, it is potentially a kind of a big burden, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. That would be the hardest thing you could ask of someone, in my opinion, is make the decision to, because what we have now, if you're going to seek the death penalty, there has to be a second phase of the trial. So you've already found the defendant guilty, and then they have to do a second phase where the jury actually has to make the decision whether it's death or life in prison. And yeah, that's a huge burden. One I can't even fathom being part of, you know?
And yeah, there's another great exchange between those two. It's where Fonda, I think he kind of goads him, and eventually Lee J. Cobb's character is like, "I'm going to kill you."
Yeah.
And I suppose it's like the debate over the importance of the words themselves, because like when you hear the evidence the first time and it's like somebody heard him say, "I'm going to kill you" in the case, it seems quite clear cut on face value. So like as a piece of evidence, hearing somebody say, "I'm going to kill you," how solid is that, do you think, as part of a prosecution case?
I think it's really good evidence for the prosecution, and I think it's really bad of the defense counsel not to point out or bring out. At that point, you want to go to witness into getting really angry. That's what Perry Mason would have done.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how realistic that is. But that's where you get closing argument. A defense attorney should point out that how often have you yelled that at your kid or your mother or your, you know, whatever. That's an argument that could have been made by an attorney. Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, the jurors aren't really there for that long. The whole film is 96 minutes in total.
Yeah.
But they quite quickly get to the stage of discussing, like, "Are we a hung jury?" and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd assume in reality, correct me on this. Please do. I'd assume we'd be talking like days before a jury can be considered hung. But you tell me, what would a sensible time frame be?
Yeah, I think days, especially in a murder case. I mean, and one of them said the judge isn't going to let us declare ourselves hung yet. We haven't been in here long enough, and that's true. They hadn't even had dinner yet. If they were to tell the bailiff we can't reach a decision, he would have ordered them dinner and told them to cool off. You know, it would have been days.
Especially because the voting changes really incredibly rapidly, doesn't there? There's huge swings in terms of who's voting for what.
Don't you think it felt like they'd been there for hours? I mean, that's how well the movie portrayed it. The movie itself is an hour and a half, but it felt like they'd been arguing about it for hours and hours.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, because I saw this film on the big screen like earlier this year, and what kind of struck me seeing it at the cinema as opposed to like on DVD or whatever is, I mean, it's obviously, you know, a very hot, sweaty film, but on the big screen, that really comes through. You can sort of see every bead of sweat on these guys' faces, you know, and it really just kind of underlines, you know, how kind of draining it must have been, I suppose.
Yeah.
And the other thing they talk about is like, you know, shall we set a time limit? And that seemed like a sensible idea to me, although, like we say, in this kind of absurdly compressed time that the film kind of sets up, I suppose. But a time limit seems like a decent idea in some ways.
I liked that when they first started the deliberations, Juror 8 says, "Look, let's just talk about it. Give me an hour. Let's just talk. Yeah. Let's not just rush to this judgment." But then they decided that they were going to set a time limit on how long they were going to go until they decided they were hung. That seemed a little less realistic. It's the judge that gets to do that.
Okay. So, right. There's a guy, one of the guys, Juror number 7, played by Jack Warden. He's the guy with the hat who's kind of...
Yeah, wants to get the game, yeah.
That's it, yeah. I mean, at one point, all the way through, he kind of clearly wants to get it all over with. And he changes his vote from guilty to not guilty, doesn't he? And he seems not to be able to, you know, explain why. It's just that he wants to go home, I think, you know.
Uh-huh.
And that seems really dangerous to me. Like, if enough people did similarly, you know, how could you be confident that justice is being done in like any meaningful sense, you know?
Yeah, I agree. With the second vote they did, where juror number 8 says, okay, we'll vote again, and if no one else has changed their vote, then I'll vote guilty. And that was the same thing to me. It's like you can't give up on your convictions. You need to keep arguing for them. You can't vote guilty if you're not convinced, and you can't vote not guilty if you think he did it, just to get out of there. So I think that's a huge problem. I mean, you instruct the jury about that. I mean, they're told, don't be swayed by other people unless you're swayed that by the evidence. You know, if you can let another juror talk you into seeing the evidence in a different way, but don't give up on your convictions.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. But at the same time, I wonder, there was an element of like calculation with Henry Fonda there, wasn't there?
Yeah.
Where he's kind of gambling, I think, that somebody's going to lend him the vote.
I thought so too. When he first was saying, okay, I'll change my vote, I thought, was he just playing games? And then you see the obvious relief on his face when the old man changes his vote. So you realize he was pretty sure he'd won someone over, you know?
So part of the evidence, or one of the pieces of evidence, is the eyewitness, probably the main piece of evidence, I suppose, the woman who quote unquote saw the murder.
Yeah.
And the jury kind of pieces it together that her eyesight wasn't great and so on.
Yeah.
I mean, I was wondering, like, if the prosecution had known this, and let's say for argument's sake, they'd encouraged her not to wear glasses when testifying, could that be considered like irresponsible?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think that whole bit was probably the most unbelievable. Oh, she didn't wear her glasses because she, you know, let's just be a little misogynistic there.
Yeah.
But the fact that defense counsel wouldn't have even questioned that wouldn't have come in. This guy was asleep. He spent no time doing any investigating. So that to me was like, I can't believe that part didn't come out at trial. That was a lot of piecing together by the jury.
Yeah, I agree. I think that seemed a bit kind of movie magic or something.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. There's a good exchange when they're talking about the glasses, though, and it kind of goes back to something you were saying earlier. It's when Lee J. Cobb's character says to Fonda, like, what do you know? And he's like, I don't know, I'm guessing, you know. And I think what's good about the film, like one of the many things that's good about it, is the film doesn't lose sight of that. We're not kind of dealing in certainties, are we?
Yeah.
You know. And I guess it's what you said. It's like, you know, reasonable doubt is the important thing, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. They go back and forth a lot. Well, I'm not sure he's innocent. I'm not sure he's guilty. And that really is the whole thing, that the defense is, even if they don't present a case, they can highlight the fact that there's a reason to doubt this. And that's what the jury's doing in their deliberations.
Well, I suppose what it leads on to is the big question is, like, was the right verdict reached? Because we never, you know, you can imagine a lesser film would give you, like, a flashback or something where you see what really happened on the night of the crime or something like that, you know, that kind of clarifies it. But we don't get that here. We don't know for certain whether the young man killed his father or not. It seems to me, just as a complete layman, but, like, it's hard to argue with the position the jury ends up in. It certainly feels right on, like, an emotional level. And a dramatic level. What do you think? Did they kind of come to the right call?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The fact that they could have, you know, they could discuss the evidence that and find reason to doubt it. How could they vote guilty if they are not sure the witnesses were accurate, if they were not sure that this kid really, you know, didn't go to the movies, or, you know, all these things that they brought up and questioned. I don't see how they could possibly vote to convict, but I am a defense attorney. So,
well, it's like, we don't know. There may have been oversights that the prosecution made, you know, the prosecution may have been able to present their case differently. And as I said, we don't really know if the conclusions the jurors came to are entirely accurate.
Yeah.
So I just like it. I like the fact we're not spoon fed stuff.
Yeah. I think that's what makes the movie so brilliant. Is all you can, you're just grappling with it along with the jury. You just don't know. And so if you don't know, then obviously the right verdict is not guilty.
Mm, yeah. And if you'd have been on this jury, Kathy, I like to think I would have been the Henry Fonda figure, but I don't know, but what stage, like, I'll assume that I would have gone in, you know, let's say I'd have gone in, you know, convinced by the prosecution case, kind of intending to vote guilty. What stage do you think Fonda would have won you round, or do you think you would have seen through this case kind of straight away? I suppose you would have with your experience.
Yeah, I think that I would like to be juror number 8. But, you know, when they took the first vote and they're showing hands, you could see that the old man just sort of hesitated and then raised his hand after he saw everyone else was doing it. And he was the first one to change his vote, and I think that would have been me. I think just getting it out in the open, saying, okay, let's talk about this. Those doubts I had in my head, they're real. I would have changed my vote pretty early on.
I mean, I like to think I'd have been one of the early ones to change. I don't think I would have changed my mind as early as the old man did, because I'm not sure I would have heard enough from Fonda's case at that point. But I'd like to think that by the next time they went round, I'd have been, you know, feeling a bit more charitable and I'd have switched sides. But I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, is there anything else about this film that you wanted to bring up, or that, you know, that you've got notes on that we haven't kind of covered? Or
the one thing that's really interesting is they talked a lot about the kid's background, about his prior knife fights and his criminal history, all these arrests and the his reform school and orphanage and all that. And none of that would come in these days. I don't know, and that is sort of a developing area of the law. It's constantly being challenged. You don't want the jury to say he's guilty because that's the type of person he is. And that's what that evidence really points to. So none of that should have been there, and it wouldn't be there now. But what I found was really interesting is the fact that he had all this experience with knife fights that shouldn't have been in there. It ended up swaying some of the jurors that he wouldn't have killed his father using the knife in that manner, because he knows how to use a switchblade, and you don't use it overhand, you use it underhand. So I thought that was really an interesting twist, you know, something the jury never should have heard and should have been prejudicial to him, ended up helping him in some way.
Yeah, I didn't think about that. Yeah, it totally ends up working in his favor, doesn't it? Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, so I guess we could wrap up there. But no, this has been really fun, I think.
It has been.
Yeah, great stuff. I mean, we'll have to talk again for something that actually involves a courtroom more prominently, I suppose. There is a remake of this film. It's with Jack Lemmon, who he's a great actor too. It was like a TV movie from the late 90s, but I haven't seen it. But I think this is I think it'd be so hard to top this film.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
At the same time, it's such a solid story that I imagine that any other rendition of it would be quite watchable, at least, but I don't know.
I can't see how they would remake it now unless they were setting it in the 50s. They couldn't do a remake, a current day remake, without making it 12 Angry People.
Yeah.
so why mess with it, because it's already so perfect the way it is.
Yeah, this is a film people should see, you know, and then preferably should see it again, is what I would say.
Right.
So. All right. So listeners, I mean, just keep an eye on social media, I'll say, for confirmation about what our next episode will be covering, because I'm tempted to give myself a week off, but we'll see. We'll see. Whatever the next episode is, whatever film we're talking about, listeners, I hope you can join us then when the curtain rises once more at the Movie Palace.